Continuing our study of man, we must now speak with more detail about the different states of consciousness. As I have already said, there are four states of consciousness possible for man: sleep, waking consciousness, self-consciousness, and objective consciousness. But he lives only in two, partly in sleep and partly in what is called waking consciousness. It is as though he had a four-storied house, but lived only in the two lower stories. The first, or the lowest state of consciousness, is sleep. This is a purely subjective and passive state. Man is surrounded by dreams. All his psychic functions work without any direction. There is no logic, no sequence, no cause, and no result in dreams. Purely subjective pictures, either reflections of former experiences or reflections of vague perceptions of the moment, such as sounds reaching the sleeping man, sensations coming from body, slight pains, sensations of muscular tension, fly through the mind, leaving only a very slight trace on the memory, and more often leaving no trace at all. The second degree of consciousness comes when man awakes. This second state, the state in which we are now, that is, in which we work, talk, imagine ourselves conscious beings, and so forth, we often call waking consciousness or clear consciousness, but really it should be called waking sleep or relative consciousness. This last term will be explained later. It is necessary to understand here that the first state of consciousness, that is, sleep, does not disappear when the second state arrives, that is, when man awakes. Sleep remains there, with all its dreams and impressions, only a more critical attitude towards one's own impressions, more connected thoughts, more disciplined actions become added to it, and because of the vividness of sense impressions, desires, and feelings, particularly the feeling of contradiction or impossibility, which is entirely absent in sleep, dreams become invisible exactly as the stars and moon become invisible in the glare of the sun. But they are all there, and they often influence all our thoughts, feelings, and actions, sometimes even more than the actual perceptions of the moment. In connection with this, I must say at once that I do not mean what is called in modern psychology the subconscious or the subconscious mind. These are simply wrong expressions, wrong terms which mean nothing and do not refer to any real facts. There is nothing permanently subconscious in us because there is nothing permanently conscious. And there is no subconscious mind for the very simple reason that there is no conscious mind. Later, we will see how this mistake occurred and how this wrong terminology came into being and became almost generally accepted. But let us return to the states of consciousness which really exist. The first is sleep. The second is waking sleep or relative consciousness. The first, as I have said, is a purely subjective state. The second is less subjective. Man already distinguishes I and not I in the sense of his body and objects different from his body, and he can, to a certain extent, orient among them and know their position and qualities. But it cannot be said that man is awake in this state, because he is very strongly influenced by dreams, and really lives more in dreams than in fact. All the absurdities and all the contradictions of people and of human life in general become explained when we realize that people live in sleep, do everything in sleep, and do not know that they are asleep. It is useful to remember that this is the inner meaning of many ancient doctrines. The best known to us is Christianity, or the gospel teaching, in which the idea that men live in sleep and must first of all awake is the basis of all the explanations of human life, although it is very rarely understood as it should be understood, in this case literally. But the question is, how can a man awake? The gospel teaching demands awakening, but does not say how to awaken. But the psychological study of consciousness shows that only when a man realizes that he is asleep is it possible to say that he is on the way to awakening. He can never awaken without first realizing his sleep. These two states, sleep and waking state, are the only two states of consciousness in which man lives. Besides them, there are two states of consciousness possible for man, but they become accessible to a man only after a hard and prolonged struggle. These two higher states of consciousness are called self-consciousness and objective consciousness. We generally think that we possess self-consciousness, that is, we are conscious of ourselves, or in any case, that we can be conscious of ourselves at any moment we wish. But in truth, self-consciousness is a state which we ascribe to ourselves without any right. Objective consciousness is a state about which we know nothing. Self-consciousness is a state in which man becomes objective towards himself. And objective consciousness is a state in which he comes into contact with the real or objective world from which he is now shut off by the senses, dreams, and subjective states of consciousness. Another definition of the four states of consciousness can be made from the point of view of the possible cognition of truth. In the first state of consciousness, that is, in sleep, we cannot know anything of the truth. Even if some real perceptions or feelings come to us, they become mixed with dreams, and in the state of sleep we cannot distinguish between dreams and reality. In the second state of consciousness, that is, in waking sleep, we can only know relative truth, and from this comes the term relative consciousness. In the third state of consciousness, that is, the state of self-consciousness, we can know the full truth about ourselves. In the fourth state of consciousness, that is, in the state of objective consciousness, we are supposed to be able to know the full truth about everything. We can study things in themselves, the world as it is. This is so far from us that we cannot even think about it in the right way, and we must try to understand that even glimpses of objective consciousness can only come in the fully developed state of self-consciousness. In the state of sleep, we can have glimpses of relative consciousness. In the state of relative consciousness, we can have glimpses of self-consciousness. But if we want to have more prolonged periods of self-consciousness and not merely glimpses, we must understand that they cannot come by themselves. They need will action. This means that frequency and duration of moments of self-consciousness depend on the command one has over oneself. So it means that consciousness and will are almost one and the same thing, or in any case, aspects of the same thing. At this point, it must be understood that the first obstacle in the way of the development of self-consciousness in man is his conviction that he already possesses self-consciousness, or at any rate, that he can have it at any time he likes. It is very difficult to persuade a man that he is not conscious and cannot be conscious at will. It is particularly difficult because here nature plays a very funny trick. If you ask a man if he is conscious, or if you say to him that he is not conscious, he will answer that he is conscious and that it is absurd to say that he is not, because he hears and understands you. And he will be quite right, although at the same time quite wrong. This is nature's trick. He will be right because your question or your remark has made him vaguely conscious for a moment. Next moment, consciousness will disappear, but he will remember what you said and what he answered, and he will certainly consider himself conscious. In reality, acquiring self-consciousness means long and hard work. How can a man agree to this work if he thinks he already possesses the very thing which is promised him as the result of long and hard work? Naturally, a man will not begin this work and will not consider it necessary until he becomes convinced that he possesses neither self-consciousness nor all that is connected with it, that is, unity or individuality, permanent I, and will. This brings us to the question of schools, because methods for the development of self-consciousness, unity, permanent I, and will can be given only by special schools. That must be clearly understood. Men on the level of relative consciousness cannot find these methods by themselves, and these methods cannot be described in books or taught in ordinary schools for the very simple reason that they are different for different people, and there is no universal method equally applicable to all. In other words, this means that men who want to change their state of consciousness need a school, but first they must realize their need. As long as they think they can do something by themselves, they will not be able to make any use of a school, even if they find it. Schools exist only for those who need them and who know that they need them. The idea of schools, the study of the kinds of schools that may exist, the study of school principles and school methods, occupies a very important place in the study of that psychology which is connected with the idea of evolution, because without a school there can be no evolution. One cannot even start, because one does not know how to start. Still less can one continue or attain anything. This means that, having got rid of the first illusion, that one already has everything one can have, one must get rid of the second illusion, that one can get anything by oneself, because by oneself one can get nothing. These lectures are not a school, not even the beginning of a school. A school requires a much higher pressure of work, but in these lectures I can give to those who wish to listen some ideas as to how schools work and how they can be found. I gave before two definitions of psychology. First, I said that psychology is the study of the possible evolution of man, and second, that psychology is the study of oneself. I meant that only a psychology which investigates the evolution of man is worth studying, and that a psychology which is occupied with only one phase of man, without knowing anything about his other phases, is obviously not complete, and cannot have any value, even in a purely scientific sense, that is, from the point of view of experiment and observation. For the present phase, as studied by ordinary psychology, in reality does not exist as something separate, and consists of many subdivisions which lead from lower phases to higher phases. Moreover, the same experiment and observation show that one cannot study psychology as one can study any other science not directly connected with oneself. One has to begin the study of psychology with oneself. Putting together first what we may know about the next phase in the evolution of man, that is, that it will mean acquiring consciousness, inner unity, permanent ego, and will, and second, certain material that we can get by self-observation, that is, realization of the absence in us of many powers and faculties which we ascribe to ourselves, we come to a new difficulty in understanding the meaning of psychology, and to the necessity for a new definition. The two definitions given in the previous lectures are not sufficient, because man by himself does not know what evolution is possible for him, does not see where he stands at present, and ascribes to himself features belonging to higher phases of evolution. In fact, he cannot study himself, being unable to distinguish between the imaginary and the real in himself. What is lying? As it is understood in ordinary language, lying means distorting or in some cases hiding the truth, or what people believe to be the truth. This lying plays a very important part in life, but there are much worse forms of lying when people do not know that they lie. I said in the last lecture that we cannot know the truth in our present state, and can only know the truth in the state of objective consciousness. How then can we lie? There seems to be a contradiction here, but in reality there is none. We cannot know the truth, but we can pretend that we know, and this is lying. Lying fills all our life. People pretend that they know all sorts of things, about God, about the future life, about the universe, about the origin of man, about evolution, about everything. But in reality, they do not know anything, even about themselves. And every time they speak about something they do not know, as though they knew it, they lie. Consequently, the study of lying becomes of the first importance in psychology. And it may lead even to the third definition of psychology, which is the study of lying. Psychology is particularly concerned with the lies a man says and thinks about himself. These lies make the study of man very difficult. Man, as he is not a genuine article. He is an imitation of something, and a very bad imitation. Imagine a scientist on some remote planet who has received from the earth specimens of artificial flowers without knowing anything about real flowers. It will be extremely difficult for him to define them, to explain their shape, their color, the material from which they are made, that is, wire, cotton wool, and colored paper, and to classify them in any way. Psychology stands in a very similar position in relation to man. It has to study an artificial man without knowing the real man. Obviously, it cannot be easy to study a being such as man, who does not himself know what is real and what is imaginary in him. So psychology must begin with a division between the real and the imaginary in man. It is impossible to study man as a whole, because man is divided into two parts, one part which, in some cases, can be almost all real, and the other part which, in some cases, can be almost all imaginary. In the majority of ordinary men, these two parts are intermixed and cannot be easily distinguished, although they are both there, and both have their own particular meaning and effect. In the system we are studying, these two parts are called essence and personality. Essence is what is born in man. Personality is what is acquired. Essence is what is his own. Personality is what is not his own. Essence cannot be lost, cannot be changed or injured as easily as personality. Personality can be changed almost completely with the change of circumstances. It can be lost or easily injured. If I try to describe what essence is, I must first of all say that it is the basis of man's physical and mental makeup. For instance, one man is naturally what is called a good sailor, another is a bad sailor. One has a musical ear, another has not. One has a capacity for languages, another has not. This is essence. Personality is all that is learned in one or another way, in ordinary language, consciously or unconsciously. In most cases, unconsciously means by imitation, which, as a matter of fact, plays a very important part in the building of personality. Even in instinctive functions, which naturally should be free from personality, there are usually many so-called acquired tastes, that is, all sorts of artificial likes and dislikes, all of which are acquired by imitation and imagination. These artificial likes and dislikes play a very important and very disastrous part in man's life. By nature, man should like what is good for him and dislike what is bad for him. But this is so only as long as essence dominates personality, as it should dominate it. In other words, when a man is healthy and normal. When personality begins to dominate essence, and when man becomes less healthy, he begins to like what is bad for him, and to dislike what is good for him. This is connected with the chief thing that can be wrong in the mutual relations of essence and personality. Normally, essence must dominate personality, and then personality can be quite useful. But if personality dominates essence, this But essence and personality must grow parallel, and the one must not outgrow the other. Cases of essence outgrowing personality may occur among uneducated people. The so-called simple people may be very good, and even clever, but they are incapable of development in the same way as people with more developed personality. Cases of personality outgrowing essence are often to be found among more cultured people, and in such cases, essence remains in a half-grown or half-developed state. This means that with a quick and early growth of personality, growth of essence can practically stop at a very early age, and as a result, we see men and women externally quite grown up, but whose essence remains at the age of 10 or 12. There are many conditions in modern life which greatly favor this underdevelopment of essence. For instance, the infatuation with sport, particularly with games, can very effectively stop the development of essence, and sometimes at such an early age that essence is never fully able to recover later. This shows that essence cannot be regarded as connected only with the physical constitution, in the simple meaning of the idea. In order to explain more clearly what essence means, I must again return to the study of functions.